Welcome to the Odyssey Podcast. This is Jean Cavellos, Director of Odyssey. Odyssey is an intensive six-week workshop for writers of fantasy, science fiction, and horror whose work is approaching publication quality. Odyssey is held each summer on the campus of St. Anselm College in Manchester, New Hampshire. Adult writers from all over the world apply. Only 16 are admitted. Top authors, editors, and agents serve as guest lecturers. For more information, visit www.odysseyworkshop.org. Podcast number 9 is an excerpt from a lecture Robert J. Sawyer gave at Odyssey in the summer of 2006, titled, Is Your Science Fiction Element Extraneous? The text of this recording is copyright 2006 by Robert J. Sawyer. The sound recording is copyright 2007 by Odyssey Writing Workshops.
So, somebody tell me what they think a story is. Let's get some story definitions to start while I catch my breath.
A story is a piece of literature with a beginning, middle, and an end.
This is a very good point. It has to have a beginning and a middle and an end. Not only that, but the end, as Orson Scott Card says, that the end has to be presaged by the beginning. In other words, you set out for where you tell people the journey you're going to go on, and then you bring them to the destination that you told them you were going to lead them to. Now, it may not be a happy journey in the end, or it may not be a sad journey, but there's got to be some real connect between the beginning, the middle, and the end. And you and I were having a conversation yesterday about a story that started 70 million years ago and ends in the present day. It's a big gap between beginning and end. When you're trying to get from the beginning to the end, I think the biggest problem is that we're setting out character situations in a lot of this stuff, in terms of a genre writing workshop, that don't have to be genre stories. Genre stories can illuminate character interactions, but they shouldn't just mundanely illuminate them in exactly the same way they would have been illuminated in any other story. So I think one of the problems is that we had a story situation where father disapproves of daughter's job, daughter ultimately manages to reaffirm father's approval, and everything is happy at the end. And the story would have played, in fact, in some ways better if it hadn't been a genre story. Take the magic gemstones out of it, and it speaks to a universal truth. Put the magic gemstones in it, and you think, well, this is not very good life advice for me from this story. Unless I develop a magic power, I will not be able to have the same sort of reconciliation. Larry brought me a story yesterday that involved one brother trying to kill another brother with an elaborate science fictional plot. And it would have worked much easier. It was, in some ways, a James Bondish kind of thing, where Blofeld or somebody doesn't just go, that's the end of you, James. He's got this elaborate machine to kill James Bond. And of course, it usually fails in the end because of the elaborateness of it. So one of the things we have to watch for in science fiction and in fantasy is a tendency to get caught up in putting all these props and accoutrements and gewgaws and so forth around a basic human story. If you have a basic human story to tell, it's perfectly possible to tell it in science fiction and fantasy. But the science fictional and fantastic motifs and devices you bring to the story should take it to another level rather than just be an elaborate way of saying something that might have just been said in a simplistic way otherwise. One of the single biggest reasons that stories get rejected in this genre by science fiction and fantasy editors is because it didn't have to be in their magazine. Or it didn't have to be in their publishing imprint. It could have been in anybody else's publishing imprint, not with changes, per se, not changing things, but deleting things. Take out this element, take out this element, take out this element, and it works just as well. The great science fiction and fantasy stories have things in them, lessons that are learned in a way that couldn't be learned any other way. It's hard to imagine The Wizard of Oz working without Oz, right? Yes, you can come to a lesson, there's no place like home, but not anywhere near as profoundly as Dorothy does by really going away from home. And what does she see when she goes away? She doesn't go to a completely alien world. She sees all of the characters that she sees, the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, the Cowardly Lion, and the Wizard, and the Wicked Witch of the West are all people who are reflections, but distorted reflections of people she actually knew. When they're the farmhands or her companions, Miss Gulch, I think is her name, is the Wicked Witch, and Professor Marvel, who is somebody she's recently encountered, is the Wizard. So she goes somewhere and sees, and this is the other thing that science fiction and fantasy do. I first heard this from Ursula K. Le Guin, but I understand it may not be original to her, but it gives us a distorting mirror, right? Any piece of, you all heard this word mimetic when you were at ReaderCon, I'm sure. John Clute and others like to throw it around. Mimetic meaning imitative, mime, imitative of real life. And that's what mainstream fiction does for you. It imitates things that are happening supposedly in real life. And you're supposed to say, yeah, that just happened to me too, or I know somebody that happened to, and it seems real to me. It's like real life. Science fiction doesn't give you that kind of mirror, which just imitates, just actually copies move for move. It gives you a distorting mirror. It amplifies or it concentrates. By amplifying, it'll take something, and we're going to talk about this when we do your story today, Terry. We take, for instance, feelings of masculine inadequacy and find a way to amplify that issue in a way that you could not do if Terry's story, which starts near the Thames in London, had stayed near the Thames in London. You never could have gotten to the degree of discussion that Terry brought to his story. Amplifies. The other thing you can do is concentrate. And most aliens in science fiction serve the purpose of concentrating a human trait. Spock is no different than Kirk in that he has exactly the same list of characteristics. He has wants, desires, a sense of humor, a sense of loyalty, a sense of adventure, a sense of fun, a sense of rationality, a sense of estrangement from members of his family. It is only the proportions that are different that make Spock different from Kirk. And we see that, indeed, it's only the proportions that make Luke Skywalker and his father different, right? One of them has gone over and let the dark side be magnified. And we do that a lot in science fiction, and that can be very useful because in general life, we don't actually have these cases of really concentrated one set or really almost completely pulling out another set of what it is to be human. And so we're fascinated by that. But science fiction lets you concentrate on something, concentrate on rationality, concentrate on masculinity, concentrate on femininity, concentrate on territoriality, which is, those of you who read my books, Farseer, Fossil Hunter, and Foreigner, concentrate on spirituality, which you often see in fantasy fiction, in magic realism, there's a degree of credulous acceptance of things that in our world we would have a degree of skepticism that would say, no, I question everything that's happening instead of accepting everything that's happening. So when you go to tell a story in science fiction and fantasy, I do think it's important that you say to yourself, why have I chosen this genre? And the answer should be, because I can say something different or more effectively by doing it in genre. And then the question should be, how am I using the tools of the genre to in fact achieve that goal? There are lots of, it's clearly true that there are all kinds of things you can say in the genre, but if that are different. But if you then don't actually pull in the tools and do something that you couldn't have done any other way, then it still fails. You say, yeah, science fiction is a great way to explore family relationships, which it is. I've done it many times myself. But if you don't do it in a science fictional way, if you don't actually bring those tools to bear, then you failed. I get asked all the time, what's my favorite of all my novels? And it's the one that happens to be my favorite is not my bestseller, and it wasn't the one that got the best reviews, but it's the one where I think I fulfilled that mission statement best of all. And it's one called Factoring Humanity that came out in 1998. Yay, all right, Adrian knows that. Thank you. Now that came out in 1998, so we're talking, I'm already resting on my laurels. It was a decade ago that I wrote it. But in that, it starts out with a strained family reunion on page one, where two adults who have a grown daughter are waiting for their grown daughter to come and visit with her boyfriend, and the daughter arrives and drops the biggest bomb that you can drop at a family gathering when an adult child shows up, and she says, "Daddy, you molested me when I was a little girl." Boom! The biggest bomb, right? Which there are millions of mainstream books about, right? Millions of them. And no doubt an important social issue, whether or not this was a novel to some degree about suppressed recovered memories, thank you. And now, what's that doing in a science fiction novel? How can I explore that in a science fiction novel. Well, of course, the main character is neither the father who's been accused or the daughter who's doing the accusing. It is the woman who is both wife and mother, who has the allegiances to these two people. And only one of them is in the right on this. And how does this get resolved? And in the course of the story, a technology is presented that allows people to go in and surf the collective unconscious the way cyberpunk cowboys surf cyberspace. But what happens is she actually gets an opportunity to find out what really happens and deal with the emotional thing that's tearing her apart. And I think that was using science fictional tools, and the technology that I developed was a way to distort and amplify the issue. And I couldn't have told the same story outside of science fiction. The standard way this comes back is what Stanley Schmidt uses as his rule of thumb whenever he's editing stuff at Analog, which is still the top-selling science fiction magazine in the English language. If you can take the science fictional element out and you still have the story, the same basic story, you don't have a science fiction story. And it doesn't belong in my magazine. The example that Stanley Schmidt always cites of a story that he wished he had been offered and he didn't get to publish, but then he wasn't the editor at the time, is Flowers for Algernon by Daniel Keyes, which is made twice now, into first time in a movie called Charlie and then later into a movie with the real title, Flowers for Algernon, which is, do you all know the story? Right? Take the science fictional element out of there, which is the temporary cure for severe retardation, and you have no story. You take the scientific element out of Frankenstein, which is Victor wants to understand how it is that decay occurs and reverse the process, and you have no story. And you should be testing what you have here and see if your science fictional or fantastic element is extraneous to your story, or if it actually is what's giving your story its new perspective. It's something of value that's new and interesting to say. Just a final little bit about stories here, because the other thing we're seeing over and over again here is questions about the endings of the story. Hardest thing to do is to know how to wrap it up. And I don't pretend that there's a magic formula for this or there's a trick, but there are some ways to approach this question. One is the one that mystery writers almost always use, which is don't start writing until you have the end, because you're kind of flailing around hoping that it's all going to come together. It's like literally the process of writing that a lot of people do is like getting up and think, okay, it's, you know, my turn to tell a joke, and I'm going to start and just hope I come up with a punchline by the time I finish talking. Okay, you know, a Klingon, a Ferengi, and a clone walk into a bar, as Data once said on Star Trek, right? And you just hope that by the time you finish setting it up, some brilliant conclusion will occur to you. Now, how often does that happen in real life? Never. It never happens in your writing, too. So certainly an ideal way to try and do this is to have your ending in mind up front. Now, that's really, really hard to do, right? It's like, oh, you know, da-da. It just comes to me full blown. Well, they never come to you full blown, but I do think, and I'm just going to echo something that I've been saying all week long, that is, if you know what it is that you're talking about, if you have a thematic statement, if you are clear in your mind about why you are telling this story, the ending should clearly suggest itself. I threw out here as an example, what's 2001 about, and nobody knew. And it's interesting that Arthur C. Clarke was interviewed a while after the film came out, and he was asked, what does the ending mean? And he says, I have no idea. Arthur C. Clarke had no idea what the ending meant of that film. And there was a case, and if you look at the development of that, where they just kind of threw in ideas, and then at the end, something had to happen to end it, and it doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense. Now, one can argue, and people have endlessly and at length for 38 years now, about what that film means, but it is quite conceivably arguable that there's no overarching vision of what they were trying to say from the outset. What were they trying to say about the evolution of man? What were they trying to say about artificial intelligence? It's quite debatable about whether or not there was an overarching statement in that film. On the films that you tend to remember, it seems clear that the author, the creator, did have a solid idea. And I think before you sit down and start writing your stories, having a really good grasp on what am I trying to say, doesn't have to be a high-level thematic statement. I'm trying to say, you know, that honor is more important than personal dignity or something. It doesn't have to be, but it has to be pretty clear that what you want to say in your story, for instance, Ellen, about reconciliation, then are you saying that reconciliation is worthwhile at all costs? Reconciliation is nice if you can get it, but it shouldn't stand in the way of what your life's true calling is. Reconciliation is incidental. People will come to love you, but you shouldn't care whether they do or not. Any number of a second level of statement, rather than it's a story about reconciliation, is a first level. It's a story about reconciliation being, and da-da-da, is the second level. Take it at least to the second level of what you want to say about it. A real man is a first level statement. A real man is, comma, because, is a second level statement and lets you sort of home in on saying, on structuring your story, and then getting to an ending that's going to be satisfactory.
The text of this recording is copyright 2006 by Robert J. Sawyer. The sound recording is copyright 2007 by Odyssey Writing Workshops.